The French were keeping at a considerable height, some 900 feet above the surface of the water, well out of range of even the longest pepper guns. Below them, a lovely and futile spread of white sail. The Channel fleet, many of the ships wreathed in smoke where they had tried a hopeless shot. More of the ships had taken up positions nearer the land, despite the terrible danger of placing themselves so close to a leeward shore. If the French could be forced to land very near the edge of the cliffs, they might yet come into range of the long guns, if briefly. Exidium and Mortiferous were racing back from Trafalgar at frantic speed with their formations, but they could not hope to arrive before the end of the week. There was not a man among them but had known to a nicety the numbers which the French could muster against them. Rationally, there had never been any cause for hope. Even so, it was a different thing to see those numbers made flesh and wing. Fully 12 of the light wooden transports which Rankin had spied out, each carried by 4 dragons, and defended by as many more besides. Lawrence had never heard of such a force in modern warfare. It was the stuff of the Crusades, when dragons had been smaller and the country more wild, the more easily to feed them. This occurring to him, Lawrence turned to Granby and said calmly, loud enough to carry back to the men, "The logistics of feeding so many dragons together must be impractical for any extended period. He will not be able to try this again soon." Granby only stared at him a moment, then, with a start, he said hurriedly, "Just so, right you are. Should we give the men a little exercise? I think we have at least 30 minutes' grace before we meet them." "Very good," Lawrence said, pushing himself up to his feet. The force of the wind was great, but braced against his straps, he was able to turn around. The men did not quite like to meet his eyes, but there was an effect. Backs straightened, whispers stopped. None of them cared to show fear or reluctance to his face. "Mr. Johns, exchange of positions, if you please," Granby called through his speaking trumpet. Shortly the top men and bellmen had run through their exchange under the direction of their lieutenants, and the men were warmed up against the biting wind. Their faces looked a little less pinched. They could not engage in true gunnery practice with the other crews so close, but with a commendable show of energy, Lieutenant Riggs had his riflemen fire blanks to loosen their fingers. Dunn had long, thin hands, at present bled white with cold. As he struggled to reload, his powder horn slipped out of his fingers and nearly went over the side. Collins only saved it by leaning nearly straight out from Temeraire's back, just barely catching the cord. Temeraire glanced back once as the shots went off, but straightened himself again without any reminder. He was flying easily, at a pace which he could have sustained for the better part of a day. His breathing was not laboured or even much quickened. His only difficulty was an excess of high spirits. As the French dragons came more closely into view, he succumbed to excitement and put on a burst of speed, but at the touch of Lawrence's hand he drew back again into the line. The French defenders had formed into a loosely woven line of battle, the larger dragons above, with the smaller ones beneath in a darting, unpredictable mass, forming a wall shielding the transport vessels and their carriers. Lawrence felt if only they could break through the line there might be some hope. The carriers, most of them of the middleweight Pêcheurs Rayés breed, were labouring greatly. The unaccustomed weight was telling on them, and he was sure they would be vulnerable to an attack. But they had 23 dragons to the French 40 and more defenders, and almost a quarter of the British force was made up of Graylings and Winchesters, no proper match for the combat weight dragons. Getting through the line would be nearly impossible, and once through, any attacker would immediately be isolated and vulnerable in turn. On Obviseria, Lenton sent up the flags for attack. "Engage the enemy more closely." Lawrence felt his own heart begin beating faster, with the tremble of excitement that would fade only after the first moments of battle. He raised the speaking trumpet and called forward, "Choose your target, Temeraire! If ever you can get us alongside a transport, you cannot do wrong!" In the confusion of the enormous crowd of dragons, he trusted Temeraire's instincts better than his own. If there was a gap in the French line, Lawrence was sure that Temeraire would see it. By way of answer, Temeraire struck out immediately for one of the outlying transports, as if he meant to go straight at it. Abruptly he folded his wings and dived, and the 3 French dragons who had closed ranks in front of him dashed in pursuit. Swivelling his wings, Temeraire halted himself in mid-air while the 3 went flashing past. With a few mighty wing strokes, he was now flying directly up towards the unprotected belly of the first carrier on the larboard side, and now Lawrence could see that this dragon, a smaller female pêcherée, was visibly tired, her wings labouring even though her pace was still regular.
"Ready, bombs!" Lawrence shouted.
As Temeraire came hurtling past the pêcherée and slashed at the French dragon's side, the crew hurled the bombs onto the deck of the transport. The crack of gunfire came from the pêcheur's back, and Lawrence heard a cry behind him. Collins threw up his arms and went limp in his harness, his rifle tumbling away into the water below. A moment later the body followed. He was dead, and one of the others had cut him loose. There were no guns on the transport itself, but the deck was built slanting like a roof. Three of the bombs rolled off before they could burst, drifting smoke as they fell uselessly. However, two exploded in time. The whole transport sagged in mid-air as the shock briefly threw the pêcheur off her pace, gaping holes torn in the wooden planking. Lawrence caught a single glimpse of a pale, staring face inside, smudged with dirt and inhuman with terror. Then Temeraire was angling away. Blood was dripping from somewhere below, a thin black stream. Lawrence leaned to check but saw no injury. Temeraire was flying well.
"Granby!" he shouted, pointing. "From his claws, the other beast!"
Granby shouted back after a moment, and Lawrence nodded. But there was no opportunity for a second pass. Two more French dragons were coming at them directly. Temeraire beat up quickly into the sky, the enemy beasts following. They had seen his trick of manoeuvring and were coming at a more cautious pace, so as not to overrun him.
"Double back! Straight down and at them!" Lawrence called to Temeraire.
"Guns ready!"
Riggs shouted behind him, as Temeraire drew a deep, swelling breath and neatly turned back on himself in mid-air. No longer at war with gravity, he plummeted towards the French dragons, roaring furiously. The tremendous volume rattled Lawrence's bones even in the face of the wind. The dragon in the lead recoiled, shrieking, and entangled the head of the second in its wings. Temeraire flew straight down between them, through the bitter smoke of the enemy gunfire, the British rifles speaking in answer. Several of the enemy dead were already cut loose and falling. Temeraire lashed out and carved a gash along the second dragon's flank as they went past. The spurting blood splashed Lawrence's trousers, fever hot against his skin. They were away, and the two attackers were still struggling to right themselves. The first was flying very badly and making shrill noises of pain. Even as Lawrence glanced behind them, he saw the dragon being turned back for France. With their advantage in numbers, Bonaparte's aviators had no need to push their dragons past injury.
"Bravely done!"
Lawrence called, unable to keep jubilation, pride, out of his voice, as absurd as it was to indulge in such sentiments at the height of so desperate a battle. Behind him, the crew cheered wildly as the second of the French dragons pulled away to find another opponent, not daring to attempt Temeraire alone. At once, Temeraire was winging back towards their original target, head raised proudly. He was still unmarked. Their formation partner, Massoria, was at the transport. 30 years of experience made her and Sutton wily, and they too had won past the line of battle to continue the attack on the already weakened pêcheur whom Temeraire had injured. A pair of the smaller, Poux de Ciel, were defending the pêcheur. Together they were more than Massoria's weight, but she was making use of every trick she had, skilfully baiting them forward, trying to make an opening for a dash at the pêcheur. More smoke was pouring from the transport's deck. Sutton's crew had evidently managed to land a few more bombs upon it.
"Flank to larboard,"
Sutton signalled from Massoria's back as they approached. Massoria made a dash at the two defenders to keep their attention on her, while Temeraire swept forward and lashed at the pêcheur's side, his claws tearing through the chain mesh with a hideous noise. Dark blood spurted. Bellowing, instinctively trying to lash out at Temeraire in defence, the pêcheur let go the beam with one foreleg. It was secure to the dragon's body by many heavy chains, but even so the transport listed visibly down, and Lawrence could hear the men inside yelling. Temeraire made an ungraceful but effective fluttering hop, and avoided the strike, still closely engaged. He tore away more of the chain mesh, and clawed the pêcheur again.
"Prepare volley!"
Riggs bellowed, and the riflemen strafed the pêcheur's back cruelly. Lawrence saw one of the French officers taking aim at Temeraire's head. He fired his own pistols, and with a second shot the man went down clutching his leg.
"Sir, permission to board!" Granby called forward.
The pêcheur's top men and riflemen had suffered heavy losses. Its back was largely cleared, and the opportunity was ideal. Granby was standing at the ready with a dozen of the men, all of them with swords drawn and hands ready to unlock their carabiners. Lawrence had been dreading this possibility of all things. It was only with deep reluctance that he gave Temeraire the word and laid them alongside the French dragon.
"Boarders away!"
he shouted, waving Granby his permission, with a low, sinking feeling in his belly. Nothing could have been more unpleasant than to watch his men make that terrifying, unharnessed leap into the waiting enemy's hands while he himself had to remain at his station. A terrible, ululating cry in the near distance. Lily had just struck a French dragon full in the face, and it was scrabbling and clawing at its own face, jerking in one direction and then the next, frenzied with the pain. Temeraire's shoulders hunched with sympathy just as the pêcheurs did. Lawrence flinched himself from the intolerable sound. Then the screaming stopped, abruptly. A sickening relief. The captain had crept out along the neck and put a bullet into his own dragon's head. Rather than see the creature die slowly as the acid ate through the skull and into the brain. Many of his crew had leapt to other dragons for safety, some even to Lily's back, but he had sacrificed the opportunity. Lawrence saw him falling alongside the tumbling dragon, and they plunged into the ocean together. He wrenched himself from the horrible fascination of the sight. The bloody struggle aboard the pêcheur's back was going well for them, and he could already see a couple of the midwing men working on the chains that secured the transport to the dragon. But the pêcheur's distress had not gone unnoticed. Another French dragon was coming towards them at speed, and some exceptionally daring men were climbing out of the holes in the damaged transport, trying to make their way up the chains to the pêcheur's back to provide assistance. Even as Lawrence caught sight of them, a couple of them slipped on the sloping deck and fell. But there were more than a dozen making the attempt, and if they were to reach the pêcheur, they would certainly turn the tide of battle against Granby and the boarders. Massoria cried out then, a long, shrill wail.
"Fall back!"
Lawrence heard Sutton shouting. She was streaming dark blood from a deep cut across her breastbone, another wound on her flank already being packed with white bandage. She dropped and wheeled away, leaving the two Pou de Ciel who had been attacking her at liberty. Though they were much smaller than Temeraire, he could not engage the pêcheur while under attack from two directions. Lawrence had either to call back the boarding party, or abandon them and hope they could take the pêcheur, securing its surrender by seizing its captain alive.
"Granby!"
Lawrence shouted. The lieutenant looked around, wiping blood from a cut on his face, and nodded as soon as he saw their position, waving them off. Lawrence touched Temeraire's side and called to him. With a last parting slash across the pêcheur's flank that laid white bone bare, Temeraire spun away, gaining some distance, and hovered to permit them to survey. The two smaller French dragons did not pursue, but remained hovering close to the pêcheur. They did not dare try to get close enough to send men over, for Temeraire could easily overwhelm them if they put themselves in so exposed a position. Yet Temeraire himself was also in some danger. The riflemen and half the bellmen had gone for the boarding party. Well worth the risk, for if they took the pêcheur, the transport could not very well continue on. If it did not fall entirely, at least the three remaining dragons would likely be forced to turn back for France. But that meant Temeraire was now undermanned, and they were vulnerable to boarding themselves. They could not risk another close engagement. The boarding party was making steady progress now against the last men resisting aboard the pêcheur's back. They would certainly outdistance the men from the transport. One of the Pou de Ciel dashed in and tried to lie alongside the pêcheur.
"At them!"
Lawrence called, and Temeraire dived instantly, his raking claws and teeth sending the smaller beast into a hurried retreat. Lawrence had to send Temeraire winging away again, but it had been enough. The French had lost their chance, and the pêcheur was crying out in alarm, twisting her head around. Granby was standing at the French dragon's neck with a pistol aimed at a man's head. They had taken the captain. At Granby's order, the chains were flung off the pêcheur, and they turned the captured French dragon's head towards Dover. She flew unwillingly and slowly, head turning back every few moments in anxiety for her captain. But she went, and the transport was left hanging wildly askew, the three remaining dragons struggling desperately under its weight. Lawrence had little opportunity to enjoy the triumph. Two fresh dragons came diving at them, a Petit Chevalier considerably larger than Temeraire, despite the name, and a middleweight Pêcheur Cornet, who dashed to seize the sagging support beam. The men still clinging to the roof through the dangling chains to the fresh dragon's crew, and in moments the transport was righted and underway again. The Poux de Ciel were coming at them again from opposite sides, and the Petit Chevalier was angling round from behind. Their position was exposed and growing rapidly hopeless.
"Withdraw, Temeraire!"
Lawrence called, bitter though the order was to give. Temeraire turned away at once, but the pursuing dragons drew nearer. He had been fighting hard now for nearly half an hour, and he was tiring. The two Poux de Ciel were working in concert, trying to herd Temeraire towards the big dragon, darting across his path of flight to slow him. The Petit Chevalier suddenly put on a burst of speed, and as he drew alongside them, a handful of men leapt over.
"Where borders?"
Lieutenant Johns shouted in his hoarse baritone, and Temeraire looked round in alarm. Fear gave him fresh energy to draw away from the pursuit. The Chevalier fell behind, and after Temeraire lashed out and caught one of the Poux de Ciel, they, too, abandoned the chase. However, there were 8 men already crossed over and latched on. Lawrence grimly reloaded his pistols, thrusting them into his belt, then lengthened his carabiner straps and stood. The 5 top men under Lieutenant Johns were trying to hold the borders at the middle of Temeraire's back. Lawrence made his way back as quickly as he dared. His first shot went wide. His second took a Frenchman directly in the chest. The man fell, coughing blood, and dangled limply from the harness. Then it was hot, frantic sword work, with the sky whipping past too quickly to see anything but the men before him. A French lieutenant was standing in front of him. The man saw his gold bars and aimed a pistol at him. Lawrence barely heard the speech the man tried to make him and paid no attention, but knocked the gun away with his sword arm and clubbed the Frenchman on the temple with his pistol butt. The lieutenant fell. The man behind him lunged, but the wind of their passage was against him, and the sword thrust scarcely penetrated the leather coat Lawrence wore. Lawrence cut the man's harness straps and kicked him off with a boot to the middle, then looked around for more boarders, but by good fortune the others were all dead or disarmed, and for their part only Challoner and Wright had fallen, except for Lieutenant Johns, who was hanging from his carabiners, blood welling up furiously from a pistol wound in his chest. Before they could try to tend him, he gave a final rattling gasp, and also was still. Lawrence bent down and closed John's dead, staring eyes, and hung his own sword back on his belt.
"Mr. Martin, take command of the top, acting lieutenant. Get these bodies cleared away."
"Yes, sir," Martin said, panting. There was a bloody gash across his cheek and red splashes of blood in his yellow hair. "Is your arm all right, captain?"
Lawrence looked. Blood was seeping a little through the rent in the coat, but he could move the arm easily, and he felt no weakness.
"Only a scratch. I will tie it up directly."
He clambered over a body and back to his station at the neck and latched himself in tight, then pulled loose his neckcloth to wrap around the wound.
"Borders repelled,"
he called, and the nervous tension left Temeraire's shoulders. Temeraire had drawn away from the battlefield, as proper when boarded. Now he turned back around, and when Lawrence looked up, he could see the whole extent of the field of battle, where it was not obscured by smoke and dragon wings. All but 3 of the transports were under no sort of attack at all. The British dragons were being heavily engaged by the French defenders. Lily was flying virtually alone. Only Nitidus remained with her, the others of their formation nowhere in Lawrence's sight. He looked for Maximus and saw him engaged closely with their old enemy, the Grand Chevalier. The intervening 2 months of growth had brought Maximus closer to his size, and the 2 of them were tearing at each other in a terrible savagery. At this distance, the sound of the battle was muffled. Instead, he could hear a more fatal one entirely, the crash of the waves, breaking upon the foot of the white cliffs. They had been driven nearly to shore, and he could see the red and white coats of the soldiers formed up on the ground. It was not yet midday. Abruptly, a phalanx of 6 heavyweight dragons broke off from the French line and dived towards the ground, all of them roaring at the top of their lungs while their crews threw bombs down. The thin ranks of redcoats wavered as in a breeze, and the mass of militia in the centre almost broke, men falling to their knees and covering their heads, though scarcely any real damage was done. 12 guns were fired off, wildly. Shots wasted, Lawrence thought in despair, and the leading transport could make its descent almost unmolested. The 4 carriers drew closer together, flying in a tight knot directly above the transport, and let the keel of the vessel carve a resting place in the ground with its own momentum.
The British soldiers in the front ranks threw up their arms as an immense cloud of dirt burst into their faces, and then almost at once half of them fell dead. The whole front of the transport had unhinged like a barn door, and a volley of rifle fire erupted from inside to mow down the front lines. A shout of "Vive l'Empereur!" went up as the French soldiers poured out through the smoke. More than 1,000 men, dragging a pair of 18-pounders with them. The men formed into lines to protect the guns as the artillerymen hurried to bring their charges to bear. The redcoats fired off an answering volley, and a few moments later the militia managed a ragged one of their own. But the Frenchmen were hardened veterans. Though dozens fell dead, the ranks shut tight to fill in their places, and the men held their ground. The four dragons who had carried the transport were flinging off their chains. Free of their burden, they rose again to join the fight, leaving the British aerial forces even more outnumbered than before. In a moment another transport would land under this increased protection, and its own carriers worsened the situation further. Maximus roared furiously, clawed free of the Grand Chevalier, and made a sudden desperate stoop towards the next transport as it began to descend. No art or manoeuvre, he only flung himself down. Two smaller dragons tried to bar his way, but he had committed his full weight to the dive. Though he took raking blows from their claws and teeth, he bowled them apart by sheer force. One was only knocked aside, the other, a red and blue barred Honneur d'Or, tumbled against the cliffs with one wing splayed helplessly. It scrabbled at the ragged stone face, sending powdery chalk flying as it tried to get purchase and climb up onto the cliff top. A light frigate, some 24 guns with a shallow draft, had been daring to stay near the coast. Now she leapt at the chance. Before the dragon could get up over the cliff's edge, her full, double-shotted broadside roared out like thunder. The French dragon screamed once over the noise and fell, broken. The unforgiving surf pounded its corpse and the remnants of its crew upon the rocks. Above, Maximus had landed on the second transport and was clawing at the chains. His weight was too much for the carriers to support, but they were struggling valiantly, and with a great heave in unison they managed to get the transport over the edge of the cliff as he finally broke the supports. The wooden shell fell 20 feet through the air and cracked open like an egg, spilling men and guns everywhere, but the distance was not great enough. Survivors were staggering to their feet almost at once, and they were safely behind their own already established line. Maximus had landed heavily behind the British lines. His sides were steaming in the cold air, blood running freely from 12 wounds and more, and his wings were drooped to the ground. He struggled to beat them again to get aloft, and could not, but fell back onto his haunches, trembling in every limb. 3,000 or 4,000 men already on the ground, and 5 guns. The British troops massed here only 20,000, and most of those militia, who were plainly unwilling to charge in the face of dragons above. Many men were already trying to run. If the French commander had any sense at all, he would scarcely wait for another 3 or 4 transports to launch his own charge, and if his men overran the gun emplacements, they could turn the artillery against the British dragons and clear the approaches completely.
"Lawrence," Temeraire said, turning his head around, "2 more of those vessels are going into land."
"Yes," Lawrence said low. "We must try and stop them. If they land, the battle on the ground is lost."
Temeraire was quiet a moment, even as he turned his path of flight onto an angle that would bring him ahead of the leading transport. Then he said,
"Lawrence, we cannot succeed, can we?"
The 2 forward lookouts, young ensigns, were listening also, so that Lawrence had to speak as much to them as to Temeraire.
"Not forever, perhaps," Lawrence said, "but we may yet do enough to help protect England. If they are forced to land one at a time, or in worse positions, the militia may be able to hold them for some time."
Temeraire nodded, and Lawrence thought he understood the unspoken truth. The battle was lost, and even this was only a token attempt.
"And we must still try, or we would be leaving our friends to fight without us," Temeraire said. "I think this is what you have meant by duty all along. I do understand, at least this much of it."
"Yes,"
Lawrence said, his throat aching. They had outstripped the transports and were over the ground now, with the militia a blurred sea of red below. Temeraire was swinging about to face the first of the transports head-on. There was only just enough time for Lawrence to put his hand on Temeraire's neck, a silent communion. The sight of land was putting heart into the French dragons. Their speed was increasing. There were two pêcheurs at the fore of the transport, roughly equal in size, and neither injured. Lawrence left it to Temeraire to decide which would be his target, and reloaded his own pistols. Temeraire stopped and hovered in mid-air before the oncoming dragons, spreading his wings as if to bar the way. His ruff raised instinctively up, the webbed skin translucent grey in the sunlight. A slow, deep shudder passed along his length as he drew breath, and his sides swelled out even further against his massive ribcage, making the bones stand out in relief. There was a strange, stretched, tight quality to his skin, so that Lawrence began to be alarmed. He could feel the air moving beneath, echoing, resonating in the chambers of Temeraire's lungs. A low reverberation seemed to build throughout Temeraire's flesh, like a drumbeat rolling.
"Temeraire!"
Lawrence called, or tried to. He could not hear himself speak at all. He felt a single, tremendous shudder travel forward along Temeraire's body, all the gathered breath caught up in that motion. Temeraire opened his jaws, and what emerged was a roar that was less sound than force. A terrible wave of noise, so vast it seemed to distort the air before him. Lawrence could not see for a moment through the brief haze. When his vision cleared, he at first did not understand. Ahead of them, the transport was shattering as if beneath the force of a full broadside, the light wood cracking like gunfire, men and cannon spilling out into the broken surf far below at the foot of the cliffs. His jaw and ears were aching as if he had been struck on the head, and Temeraire's body was still trembling beneath him.
"Lawrence, I think I did that," Temeraire said.
He sounded more shocked than pleased. Lawrence shared his sentiments. He could not immediately bring himself to speak. The four dragons were still attached to the beams of the ruined transport, and the fore dragon to larboard was bleeding from its nostrils, choking and crying in pain. Hurrying to save the dragon, its crew cast off the chains, letting the fragment fall away, and it managed the last quarter mile to land behind the French lines. The captain and crew leapt down at once. The injured dragon was huddled and pawing at its head, moaning. Behind them, a wild cheer was going up from the British ranks, and gunfire from the French. The soldiers on the ground were shooting at Temeraire.
"Sir, we are in range of those cannon, if they get them loaded," Martin said urgently.
Temeraire heard and dashed out over the water, for the moment beyond their reach, and hovered in place. The French advance had halted for a moment, several of the defenders milling about, wary of coming closer, and as confused as Lawrence and Temeraire himself were. But in a moment the French captains above might understand, or at least collect themselves. They would make a concerted attack on Temeraire and bring him down. There was only a little time left in which to make use of the surprise.
"Temeraire," he called urgently, "fly lower and try if you can striking at those transports from below, at cliff height. Mr. Turner," he said, turning to the signal ensign, "give those ships below a gun and show them the signal for engage the enemy more closely. I believe they will take my meaning."
"I will try," Temeraire said uncertainly,
and dived lower, gathering himself and once again taking that tremendous, swelling breath. Curving back upwards, he roared once again, this time at the underside of one of the transports still over the water. The distance was greater, and the vessel did not wholly shatter, but great cracks opened in the planks of the hull. The four dragons above were at once desperately occupied in keeping it from breaking open all the rest of the way. An arrowhead formation of French dragons came diving directly towards them, some six heavyweight dragons behind the Grand Chevalier in the lead. Temeraire darted away and, at Lawrence's touch, dropped lower over the water, where half a dozen frigates and three ships of the line lay in wait. As they swept past, their long guns spoke in a rolling broadside, one gun after another, scattering the French dragons into shrill confusion as they tried to avoid the flying grapeshot and cannonballs.
"Now, quickly, the next one!"
Lawrence called to Temeraire, though the order was scarcely necessary. Temeraire had already doubled back upon himself. He went directly at the underside of the next transport in line, the largest, flown by four heavyweight dragons, and with ensigns of golden eagles flying from the deck.
"Those are his flags, are they not?" Temeraire called back. "Bonaparte is on there?"
"More likely one of his marshals,"
Lawrence shouted over the wind, but he felt a wild excitement anyway. The defenders were forming up again at a higher elevation, ready to come after them once more, but Temeraire beat forward with ferocious zeal and outdistanced them. This larger transport, made of heavier wood, did not break as easily. Even so, the wood cracked like the sound of pistol shot, splinters flying everywhere. Temeraire dived down to attempt a second pass. Suddenly Lily was flying alongside them, and Obvisaria on their other side. Lenten, bellowing through his speaking trumpet,
"Go at them! Just go at them! We will take care of those damned buggers!"
And the two of them whirled to intercept the French defenders coming after Temeraire again. But even as Temeraire began his climb, fresh signals went up from the damaged transport. The four dragons who were carrying it together wheeled around and began to pull away, and across the battlefield all the transports still aloft gave way and turned for the long and weary flight back in retreat to France.
Epilogue. "Lawrence, be a good fellow and bring me a glass of wine," Jane Roland said, all but falling into the chair beside his, without the slightest care for the ruin she was making of her skirts.
"Two sets is more than enough dancing for me. I'm not getting up from this table again until I leave."
"Should you prefer to go at once?" he asked, rising. "I'm happy to take you."
"If you mean I am so ungainly in a dress that you think I cannot walk a quarter of a mile over even ground without falling down, you may say so, and then I will knock you on the head with this charming reticule," she said with her deep laugh. "I have not got myself up in this fashion to waste it by running away so soon. Exidium and I will be back at Dover in a week, and then Lord knows how long it will be before I have another chance to see a ball, much less one supposedly in our honour. I will fetch and carry with you, Lawrence. If they are not going to feed us anything more than these French tidbits, I'm going to get more of them," Chenery said, getting up from his chair as well.
"Hear, hear," Berkeley said. "Bring the platter."
They were parted at the tables by the crush of the crowd, which was growing extreme as the hour drew on. London society was still nearly delirious with joy over the joint victories at Trafalgar and Dover, and temporarily as happy to enthuse over the aviators as it had been to disdain them before. His coat and bars won him enough smiles and gestures of precedence that Lawrence managed to acquire the glass of wine without great difficulty. Reluctantly he gave up the notion of taking a cigar for himself. It would have been the height of rudeness to indulge, while Jane and Harcourt could not. He took a second glass instead. He imagined someone at the table would care for it. Both his hands thus occupied, he was happily not forced to do more than bow slightly when he was addressed on his way back to the table.
"Captain Lawrence," Miss Montague said, smiling with a great deal more friendliness than she had shown him in his parents' house. She looked disappointed to not be able to give him her hand. "How splendid it is to see you again. It has been ages since we are all together at Woolerton Hall. How is dear Temeraire? My heart was in my throat when I heard of the news. I was sure you should be in the thick of the battle, and so, of course, it was."
"He is very well, thank you," Lawrence said, as politely as he could manage. "Dear Temeraire" rankled extremely. But he was not going to be openly rude to a woman he had met as one of his parents' guests, even if his father had not yet been softened by society's new approbation. There was no sense in aggravating the quarrel, and perhaps needlessly making his mother's situation more difficult.
"May I present you to Lord Winsdale?" she said, turning to her companion. "This is Captain Lawrence, Lord Allendale's son, you know," she added, in an undertone that Lawrence could barely hear.
"Certainly, certainly," Winsdale said, offering a very slight nod, what he appeared to think a piece of great condescension.
"Quite the man of the hour, Lawrence. You are to be highly commended. We must all count ourselves fortunate that you were able to acquire the animal for England."
"You are too kind to say so, Winsdale," Lawrence said, deliberately forward to the same degree. "You must excuse me. This wine will grow too warm shortly."
Miss Montague could hardly miss the shortness of his tone now. She looked angry for a moment, then said with great sweetness,
"Of course. Perhaps you are going to see Miss Galman, and can bear her my greetings. Oh, but how absurd of me. I must say Mrs. Woolvey now, and she is not in town any longer, is she?"
He regarded her with dislike. He wondered at the combination of perception and spite that had enabled her to ferret out the former connection between himself and Edith.
"No, I believe she and her husband are presently touring the Lake Country," he said,
and bowed himself away, deeply grateful that she had not had the opportunity of surprising him with the news. His mother had given him intelligence of the match in a letter sent only shortly after the battle, and reaching him still at Dover. She had written after conveying the news of the engagement.
"I hope what I write does not give you too much pain. I know you have long admired her, and indeed I have always considered her charming, although I cannot think highly of her judgment in this matter."
The true blow had fallen long before the letter came. News of Edith's marriage to another man could not be unexpected, and he had been able to reassure his mother with perfect sincerity. Indeed, he could not fault Edith's judgment. In retrospect, he saw how very disastrous the match would have been on both sides. He could not have spared her so much as a thought for the last 9 months or so. There was no reason Wolfie should not make Edith a perfectly good husband. He himself certainly could not have, and he thought that he would truly be able to wish her happy if he saw her again. But he was still irritated by Miss Montague's insinuations, and his face had evidently set into somewhat forbidding lines. As he came back to the table, Jane took the glasses from him and said,
"You were long enough about it. Was someone pestering you? Do not pay them any mind. Take a turn outside and see how Temeraire is enjoying himself. That will put you in a better frame of mind."
The notion appealed immensely.
"I think I will, if you will pardon me," he said, with a bow to the company.
"Look in on Maximus for me. See if he wants any more dinner," Berkeley called after him.
"And Lily?"
Harcourt said, then looked guiltily about to see if any of the guests at the nearby tables had overheard. Naturally, the company did not realize that the women with the aviators were themselves captains, and assumed them, rather, wives, though Jane's scarred face had earned several startled looks, which she ignored with perfect ease. Lawrence left the table to their noisy and dispirited discussion, making his way outdoors. The ancient covert near London had long ago been encroached upon by the city, and given up by the corps, save for use by couriers, but for the occasion it had been briefly reclaimed, and a great pavilion established at the northern edge where the headquarters had once stood. By the aviator's request, the musicians had been set at the very edge of the pavilion, where the dragons could gather around outside to listen. The musicians had been at first somewhat distressed by the notion, and inclined to edge their chairs away, but as the evening wore on and the dragons proved a more appreciative audience than the noisy crowd of society, their fear was gradually overcome by their vanity. Lawrence came out to find the first violinist having abandoned the orchestra entirely, and playing snatches of various airs in a rather didactic manner for the dragons, demonstrating the work of different composers. Maximus and Lily were among the interested group, listening with fascination and asking a great many questions. Lawrence saw, after a moment with some surprise, that Temeraire was instead curled up in a small clearing beyond the others, off to the side, and talking with a gentleman whose face Lawrence could not see. He skirted the group and approached, calling Temeraire's name softly. The man turned, hearing him. With a start of pleasant surprise, Lawrence recognized Sir Edward Howe, and hurried forward to greet him.
"I am very happy indeed to see you, sir," Lawrence said, shaking his hand.
"I had not heard that you were back in London, although I made a point of inquiring after you when we first arrived."
"I was in Ireland when the news reached me. I've only just come to London," Sir Edward said,
and Lawrence only then noticed that he was still in travelling clothes and his boots were dust-stained.
"I hope you will forgive me. I presumed on our acquaintance to come, despite the lack of a formal invitation, in hopes of speaking with you at once. When I saw the crowd inside, I thought it best to come and stay with Temeraire until you appeared, rather than try to seek you within."
"Indeed, I am in your debt for putting yourself to so much trouble," Lawrence said. "I confess I have been very anxious to speak with you, ever since discovering Temeraire's ability, which I expect is the news which has brought you. All he can tell us is that the sensation is now the same as that of roaring. We cannot account for how mere sound might produce so extraordinary an effect, and none of us have ever heard of anything like."
"No, you would not have," Sir Edward said. "Lawrence."
He stopped and glanced at the crowd of dragons between them and the pavilion, all now rumbling in approval at the close of the first performance.
"Might we speak somewhere in more privacy?"
"We can always go to my own clearing, if you would like to be somewhere quieter," Temeraire said. "I am happy to carry you both, and it will not take me a moment to fly there."
"Perhaps that would be best, if you have no objection,"
Sir Edward asked Lawrence, and Temeraire brought them over carefully in his foreclaws, setting them down in the deserted clearing before settling himself comfortably.
"I must beg your pardon for putting you to such trouble and interrupting your evening," Sir Edward said.
"Sir, I assure you I am very happy to have it interrupted in this cause," Lawrence said. "Pray have no concern on that score."
He was impatient to learn what Sir Edward might know, a concern over Temeraire's safety from some possible agent of Napoleon's lingered with him, perhaps even increased by the victory.
"I will keep you in suspense no longer," Sir Edward said, "although I do not in the least pretend to understand the mechanical principles by which Temeraire's ability operates. The effects are described in literature, and so I may identify it for you. The Chinese, and the Japanese for that matter, call it by the name Divine Wind. This tells you little beyond what you already know from example, I am afraid, but the true importance lies in this. It is an ability unique to one breed, and one breed alone. The Celestial."
The name hung in silence for long moments. Lawrence did not immediately know what to think. Temeraire looked between them uncertainly.
"Is that very different from an Imperial?" he asked. "Are they not both Chinese breeds?"
"Very different indeed," Sir Edward answered him. "Imperial dragons are rare enough, but the Celestials are given only to the emperors themselves, or their nearest kin. I should be surprised if there were more than a few score in all the world."
"The emperors themselves," Lawrence repeated, in wonder and slowly growing comprehension.
"You will not have heard this, sir, but we took a French spy at the covert in Dover shortly before the battle. He revealed to us that Temeraire's egg was meant not merely for France, but for Bonaparte himself."
Sir Edward nodded.
"I'm not surprised to hear as much. The Senate voted Bonaparte the crown in May before last. The time of your encounter with the French vessel suggests the Chinese gave him the egg as soon as they learned. I cannot imagine why they should have made him such a gift. They have given no other signs of allying themselves with France. But the timing is too exact for any other explanation."
"And if they had some notion of when to expect the hatching, that might well explain the mode of transport as well,"
Lawrence finished for him. 7 months from China to France, around Cape Horn. The French could hardly have hoped to manage it except with a fast frigate, regardless of the risk."
"Lawrence," Sir Edward said, with pronounced unhappiness, "I must heartily beg your forgiveness for having so misled you. I cannot even plead the excuse of ignorance. I have read descriptions of Celestials, and seen many drawings of them. It simply never occurred to me that the ruff and tendrils might not develop save with maturity. In body and wing shape they are identical to the Imperials."
"I beg you not to refine upon it, sir. No forgiveness is called for in the least," Lawrence said. "It could scarcely have made much difference to his training, and in the event we have learned of his ability in very good time."
He smiled up at Temeraire, and stroked the sleek foreleg beside him, while Temeraire snorted in happy agreement.
"So, my dear, you are a Celestial. I should not be surprised at all. No wonder Bonaparte was in such a taking to lose you."
"I imagine he will continue angry," Sir Edward said. "And what is worse, we may have the Chinese on our necks over it when they learn. They are prickly to an extreme where the Emperor's standing may be said to be concerned, and I do not doubt they will be annoyed to see a British serving officer in possession of their treasure."
"I do not see how it concerns either Napoleon or them in the least," Temeraire said, bristling. "I am no longer in the shell, and I do not care if Lawrence is not an emperor. We defeated Napoleon in battle and made him fly away even though he is one. I cannot see that there is anything particularly nice about the title."
"Never fret, my dear. They have no grounds on which to make objection," Lawrence said. "We did not take you from a Chinese vessel, arguably a neutral, but from a French man of war. They chose to hand your egg to our enemy, and you were wholly lawful prize."
"I am glad to hear it," Sir Edward said,
though he looked doubtful.
"They may still choose to be quarrelsome about it. Their regard for the laws of other nations is very small, and vanishes entirely where it conflicts with their own notions of proper behaviour. Pray, have you any notion of how they stand with respect to us?"
"They could make a pretty loud noise, I suppose,"
Lawrence said uncertainly.
"I know they have no navy to speak of, but one hears a great deal of their dragons.
I will bring the news to Admiral Lenton, though, and I am sure he will know better than I do how to meet any possible difference of opinion with them over the matter." A rushing sound of wings came overhead, and the ground shook with impact. Maximus had come flying back to his own clearing, only a short distance away. Lawrence could see his red-gold hide visible through the trees. Several smaller dragons flew past overhead also, going back to their own resting places. The ball was evidently breaking up, and Lawrence realized from the low-burning lanterns that the hour had grown late.
"You must be tired from your journey," he said, turning back to Sir Edward. "I am once again deeply obliged to you, sir, for bringing me this intelligence. May I ask you, as a further favour, to join me for dinner tomorrow? I do not wish to keep you standing about in this cold, but I confess I have a great many questions on the subject I should like to put to you, and I would be happy to learn anything more you know of Celestials."
"It will be my pleasure," Sir Edward said, and bowed to both of them.
"No, I thank you, I can find my own way out," he said, when Lawrence would have accompanied him.
"I grew up in London, and would often come wandering about here as a boy, dreaming of dragons. I dare say I know the place better than do you, if you have only been here a few days."
He bade them farewell, having arranged the appointment. Lawrence had meant to stay the night at a nearby hotel where Captain Roland had taken a room, but he found he was disinclined to leave Temeraire. Instead, he searched out some old blankets in the stable being used by the ground crew, and made himself a somewhat dusty nest in Temeraire's arms, his coat rolled up to serve as a pillow. He would make his apologies in the morning. Jane would understand.
"Lawrence, what is China like?" Temeraire asked idly, after they had settled down together, his wings sheltering them from the wintry air.
"I have never been, my dear, only to India," he said, "but I understand it is very splendid. It is the oldest nation in the world, you know. It even predates Rome, and certainly their dragons are the finest in the world," he added, and saw Temeraire preen with satisfaction.
"Well, perhaps we may visit when the war is over and we have won. I would like to meet another Celestial some day," Temeraire said. "But as for their sending me to Napoleon, that is great nonsense. I am never going to let anyone take you from me."
"Nor I, my dear," Lawrence said, smiling, despite all the complications which he knew might arise if China did object. In his heart he shared the simplicity of Temeraire's view of the matter, and he fell asleep almost at once in the security of the slow, deep rushing of Temeraire's heartbeat, so very much like the endless sound of the sea. Selected extracts from Observations on the Order Draconia in Europe, with Notes on the Oriental Breeds, by Sir Edward Howe, FRS. London, John Murray, Albemarle Street, 1796. Prefatory note from the author on the measure of dragon weights. Incredulity is the likely response of most of my readers to the figures which appear hereinafter to describe the weight of various dragon breeds, as being wholly disproportionate to those which have hitherto been reported. The estimate of 10 tons for a full-grown regal copper is commonly known, and such prodigious bulk must already strain the imagination. What then must the reader think when I report this vast understatement and claim a figure closer to 30 tons, indeed reaching so high as 50 for the largest of this breed? For explanation, I must direct the reader to the recent work of Monsieur Cuvier. In his latest anatomical studies of the air sacs which enable draconic flight, Monsieur Cuvier has drawn in turn upon the work of Mr. Cavendish and his successful isolation of those peculiar gases lighter than the general composition of the air which fill the sacs, and has correspondingly proposed a new system of measurement which, by compensating for the weight displaced by the air sacs, provides a better degree of comparison between the weight of dragons and that of other large land animals lacking in these organs. Those who have never seen a dragon in the flesh, and most particularly never one of the very largest breeds, in whom this discrepancy shall appear the most pronounced, may be sceptical. Those who have had the opportunity, as I have, of seeing a regal copper side by side with the very largest of the Indian elephants, who have been measured at some 6 tons themselves, will, I hope, join me in greatly preferring a scheme of measurement which does not ridiculously suggest that the one, who could devour the other nearly in a bite, should weigh less than twice as much. Sir Edward Howe, December 1795. Chapter 5. Breeds native to the British Isles, common breeds, relation to continental breeds, the effect of modern diet upon size, heredity of regal copper, venomous and vitriolic breeds. It is as well to recollect that yellow reapers, so often unjustly regarded with that contempt engendered by familiarity, are to be found everywhere because of their many excellent qualities. Generally hardy and not fastidious in their diet, untroubled by all but the worst extremes of heat or cold, almost invariably good-humoured in character, they have contributed to almost every bloodline in these isles. These dragons fall squarely into the middle weight range, though they range more widely within the breed than most, from a weight of some 10 tons to as many as 17 in a recent large specimen. Ordinarily they fall between 12 and 15 tons, with a length generally of 50 feet and a nicely proportioned wingspan of 80 feet. Malachite reapers are most easily distinguished from their more common cousins by coloration, while yellow reapers are mottled yellow, sometimes with white tiger striping along their sides and wings. Malachite reapers are a more muted yellow-brown, with pale green markings. They are generally believed to be the result of unguided interbreeding during the Anglo-Saxon conquests between yellow reapers and Scandinavian lindorms. Preferring cooler climes, they are generally to be found in northeastern Scotland. From hunting records and bone collections, we know that the grey widowmaker breed was once very nearly as common as the reapers, though now they are rarely to be found, this breed being so violently intractable and given to stealing domesticated cattle has been made nearly extinct through hunting, though some individuals may be found living wild even to this day in isolated mountainous regions, particularly in Scotland, and a few more have been coaxed into breeding grounds to preserve as basic stock. They are small and aggressive by nature, rarely exceeding 8 tons, and their coloration of mottled grey is ideal for concealment while flying, which inspired their cross-breeding with the more even-tempered Winchesters to produce the Greyling breed. The most common French breeds, the Pêcheur Cornet and Pêcheur Rayé, are more closely related to the Widowmaker breed than to the Reapers, if we may judge by wing conformation and the structure of the breastbone, which in both breeds is keeled and fused with the clavicle. This anatomical peculiarity renders them both more useful for breeding down into light combat and courier breeds, rather than into heavy combat breeds. Crossbreeding with continental species is also the source of all the heavyweight breeds now to be found in Britain, none of which can be considered properly native to our shores. Most likely this is due to climate. Heavier dragons greatly prefer warm environs, where their air sacs can more easily compensate for their tremendous weight. It has been suggested that the British Isles cannot support herds vast enough to sustain the largest breeds. The flaws to this chain of reasoning may be shown by consideration of the very wide variations in diet to be tolerated among dragons insofar as quantity is concerned. In the wild, it is well known, dragons eat so infrequently as once every 2 weeks, particularly in summer when they prefer to sleep a great deal, and their natural prey are at their fattest. It will then come as no surprise to learn that dragons in the wild do not begin to approach the sizes which can be found among their domesticated cousins, fed daily and more, particularly during the early years so critical to growth. By way of example, we have only to consider the barren desert regions of Almeria, in the southeast of Spain, scantly inhabited by goats, which are the native grounds of the fierce Cauchador Real, part ancestor of our own regal copper. In domestication, this breed reaches a fighting weight of some 25 tons, but in the wild it's scarcely to be found over 10 or 12 tons. The regal copper exceeds in size all other breeds presently known, reaching in maturity as many as 50 tons in weight and 120 feet in length. They are dramatic in colour, shading from red to yellow with much variation between individuals. The male of the species is, on the average, slightly smaller than the female, and develops forehead horns in maturity. Both sexes have a marked spiny column along the back, which renders them particularly hazardous targets for boarding operations. These great beasts are unquestionably the greatest triumph of the British breeding grounds, the product of some 10 generations' labour and careful crossbreeding, and illustrative of the unanticipated benefits which may be yielded by matings not, perhaps, of obvious value. It was Roger Bacon who first proposed the notion of breeding females of the smaller, bright copper species through the great sire Conquistador, brought to England as part of the dowry of Eleanor of Castile. Though his suggestions were founded in the erroneous supposition of the time, which thought colour to be indicative of some elemental influence, and the shared orange colour of the two breeds a sign of underlying congruence, the cross was a fruitful one, leading to offspring even larger than their prodigious sire, and better able to sustain flight over distance. Mr. Josiah Colquhoun of Glasgow has suggested that the disproportionate size of the air sacs of the bright copper, relative to their frame, properly deserves the credit for this success, and it is certain that regal coppers share this trait of their female progenitors. Monsieur Cuvier's anatomical studies suggest that indeed the vast bulk of the regal copper would crush the very breath out of the dragon's lungs if unsupported by aught but their surprisingly delicate skeletal systems. While no pyrogenic species are to be found in the British Isles, despite many attempts on the part of our breeders to induce this most valuable trait, so deadly to our shipping in the persons of the French Flamme de Gloire and the Spanish Flecha del Fuego, the native sharp-spitter breed is notable for producing a venom to incapacitate its prey. Though the sharp-spitter itself is too small and low-flying to be of great value as a fighting beast, cross-breeding with a French honneur d'or for size, and with a Russian ironwing, another venomous species, yielded several valuable crosses. Better flyers, middleweight in size, with more potent venom. Interbreeding among these, with frequent infusions from the parent breeds, culminated in the successful hatching of the first dragon, which can probably be termed a longwing, during the reign of Henry VII. In this breed, the venom had become so potent as to be more properly termed acid, and of a strength which could be turned not only against other beasts, but against targets upon the ground. The only other truly vitriolic breeds known to us at present are the Copacati, an Incan breed, and the Ka-ryu of Japan. Longwings are unfortunately instantly identifiable upon the battlefield and impossible to decoy, due to the unusual proportions for which they are named. Though they rarely exceed 60 feet in length, wingspans of 120 feet are not uncommon among them, and their wing coloration is particularly dramatic, shading from blue to orange, with vivid black and white striations at the rims. They possess the same yellow-orange eyes as their progenitor, the sharpspitter, which are exceptionally good. Though the breed was first considered intractable, and indeed some consideration was given to their destruction as too dangerous to be left unharnessed, during the reign of Elizabeth I, new methods of harnessing were developed which secured the general domestication of the breed, and they were instrumental in the destruction of the Armada. Chapter 17. Comparison of Oriental and Western Breeds. Antiquity of the Oriental Breeds. Known breeds native to the empires of China and Japan. Distinguishing characteristics of the Imperial. A note on the Celestial. The secrets of the Imperial breeding program are most jealously guarded, as the national treasures which they assuredly are, and transmitted strictly through word of mouth among a trusted line, and through documents encoded by closely held ciphers. Very little is therefore known in the West, and indeed anywhere outside the precincts of the Imperial capital, about these breeds. Brief observations by travellers have yielded only a handful of incomplete details. We know that the Imperial and Celestial are distinguished by the number of talons on their claws, which are 5, unlike virtually every other draconic breed, being 4-fingered. Similarly, their wings have 6 spines rather than the 5 common to European breeds. In the Orient, these breeds are popularly supposed to be highly superior in intelligence, retaining into adulthood that remarkable facility of memory and linguistic ability which dragons ordinarily lose early in life. For the veracity of this claim, we have but one recent witness, though a reliable one. Monsieur le Comte de la Pérouse encountered an imperial dragon at the Korean court, who, through their close relations to the court of China, have been often granted the privilege of an imperial egg. The first Frenchman to attend at this court in recent memory, he was asked for lessons in his native tongue, and by his reports, the dragon, though full-grown, was well able to hold a conversation by the time of his departure, some 1 month later, an achievement hardly to be scorned even by a gifted linguist. That the Celestial is closely related to the Imperial may be inferred from the few illustrations we in the West have managed to obtain of this breed, but very little else is known of them. The Divine Wind, that most mysterious of draconic abilities, is known to us only by hearsay, which would have us believe that the Celestials are able to produce earthquakes or storms, capable of levelling a city.
Plainly, the effects have been heartily exaggerated, but there is considerable practical respect for the ability among the Oriental nations, which cautions against any rash dismissal of this gift as pure fantasy.
This is Simon Vance. We hope you've enjoyed this production of His Majesty's Dragon by Naomi Novik. Published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House, Inc. Text copyright 2006 by Naomi Novik. Production copyright 2007, Books on Tape.